She is the founder of Circle of Health International, a U.S.-based NGO that works with women and their communities in times of crisis and disaster to ensure access to quality maternal and newborn care. Her community organizing background ranges from violence against women to welfare and poverty issues to anti-war campaigns. She has worked with refugee communities in Boston, Massachusetts, and with midwives in northern India, Guatemala, Tibet, Palestine, tsunami-affected Sri Lanka, Sudan, Tanzania, Haiti, and Israel. She has also done important work with commercial sex workers on HIV/AIDS issues in Vietnam and with female evacuees from Hurricanes Rita and Katrina in Louisiana. I could go on and on, but I think she probably just wants to get here. Let me introduce Sarah Bonds.
Good morning, everybody. How's everybody? Good. Cool. Welcome to Texas, those of you who came from far away, and for those of you who didn't come so far, isn't it a lovely fall day here for us? I was on the phone with somebody the other day who had been posting on Facebook that she's from Texas, she's in New England, and she was so grateful to be in a place where the leaves were changing. But I have noticed that we've got some foliage going on here these days, so I think we have the rain to thank for that. Anyway, we're so glad that you guys are here with us today. I heard the session downstairs went a little late, so people, I think, are still going to trickle in. So we'll just keep the doors open and try not to be too distracted. So we're here today to talk about driving social good in the workplace. I think that it is a common held belief that those are sort of exclusive, that they don't often go together, social good and the workplace. There are some people who feel that the work that they do is simply how they make a living, and they save the sort of values and the mission-driven part of themselves for something else. And then there are those of us who feel unbelievably lucky to be able to fuse our own missions with making a living and doing what we love. And so we have a variety of people living this and different kinds of experiences. And I opted not to read bios today. I'm going to let everybody introduce themselves the way that they want you guys to know about them, you ladies to know about them. So I'm going to now invite our panelists to introduce themselves, tell you a little bit about where they come from, what they do, and what it is that inspires them. And then we'll move into the topic. So whoever would like to start can go ahead.
My name is Laura Huffman. Good morning, everyone. I work for the Nature Conservancy. I'm the state director here in Texas. I work out of our Austin office, and I'm a native Austinite, so I didn't move very far. What inspires me is finding a way to reshape conversations about great big complicated issues so that we can actually solve the problems. And in the environmental space, we have tons of challenges, but also lots of opportunities to do just that.
Can you hear me? Yeah. My name is Sherry Rulin. I'm an orthodontist from Tyler, Texas. So I'm a little bit different in that my philanthropy work is volunteer and something I do on the side. I've been practicing dentistry and orthodontics for 17 years. I'm married with two children, ages 10 and 11, so I'm also a full-time mom. But a few years ago, I read a book called Lone Survivor by Marcus Luttrell. Has anyone in here read that book? Familiar? I figured it's a life-changing book. But that book was so impactful to me that a few years ago, I was inspired to share that story with my friends, share that book, and give it to anybody that I could get to read it. And that book was so impactful that my friends and I decided to start a military charity called the Boot Campaign, which to date has raised $6 million in funds in just 2 years and has started a nationwide movement spreading patriotism around this country. And that's why I'm here today.
Well, as someone who had a terrible mouth of teeth, I'd say that your day job is philanthropy, too. My name is Jessica Shortall. I am currently the Director of Site Giving and Operations Innovation at Tom's, formerly known as Tom's Shoes. But as my title denotes, I built and ran our shoe giving program. If you're not familiar with, raise your hand if you don't know what Tom's is. Okay. So we're a shoe company. Well, we were a shoe company, founded about 7 years ago on the promise that with every pair of shoes we sell, we will give a new pair of shoes to a child in need. I joined about 4.5 years ago when the company was very small and helped build out and then run our shoe giving program. We give shoes globally through nonprofit and non-governmental organizations that are working deeply in communities to impact children's health and education. So they sort of inject shoes into that as a way to boost their impact, whether it's for school attendance or prevention of disease, things like that. And more recently, we've launched a line of eyewear. So that's currently sunglasses, and in the new year, we'll be selling prescription frames as well for those of you that need glasses to see. And with every pair of our eyewear that we sell, we fund a sight-saving or sight-restoring service for someone in need. So that's everything from glasses to cataract surgery, literally restoring people from blindness. So that's my job now at Tom's, and that's why it's not called Tom's Shoes anymore. And I live here in Austin with my two very small children and my husband, and had the good fortune of spending my whole career in that place where impact meets some kind of sustainable business model on both the nonprofit and now the for-profit side. So excited to be here.
Great. Thank you, panelists. I think we can all agree that we're going to have a very dynamic conversation today with lots of different opinions and experiences present. So thanks for coming and for bringing all of that. So my hope today is that this can be more of a conversation and not just me up here reading out questions and the three panelists responding. I myself, as a participant in these events, find them much more dynamic when there's an actual sort of banter happening. And we hope to leave plenty of time at the end for questions from the audience as well. So if you have thoughts or comments that you would like to make as we go through, please keep a list, and hopefully we can hear from you at the end. So we'd like to start the conversation today by considering, in this very complex world of environmental and climate change and labor impact, all of these different elements in the business sector that could be mission-driven. So you have sort of the mission-driven element of work. And then you have the element of social responsibility, that we know that many businesses have this sort of carved out separate section of their workplace called social responsibility. I think that it is interesting to hear from folks in the nonprofit sector what is our understanding of what social responsibility means in the business sector. So would anybody like to start with that?
Yeah. So coming from the business side of things, I said this earlier this morning in another session that in an ideal world, I think businesses should have to sign the Hippocratic Oath that doctors sign, at least the first part that says first do no harm. That's actually impossible to achieve. So a company that I think is held up rightly for their social responsibility, like Patagonia, they'll say there's actually no way to produce and sell products without doing harm. So really the objective is to minimize that as much as possible. To me, that's sort of step one, right? Reduce the amount of harm you're doing in the world. And then to me after that, it's looking at how you run your business to do good in the world, ideally so that it's sustainable when the tough financial times come for a company, done in a way that has some kind of positive impact for your brand equity, for your bottom line, whatever it is, so that you want to keep doing it. Because I'm a very pragmatic person. When you have, the end of the quarter coming up and you have to make hard decisions, the stuff that's not essential will go away. So to me, sort of shaming companies into doing things is not going to change things. If we can help them figure out how to do things in a way that will benefit their business, they'll stick around a lot longer.
I'll provide a perspective from a conservation organization. I'm seeing a real shift in the business community right now, and I'll kind of walk you through it. First of all, you're driving that shift. So more corporations are investing in conservation and social equity issues because you're demanding it as employees. So that shift is well underway. To me, the shift that we need to accelerate is the small giving as a token of that mission piece versus the really big at-scale funding. So let me tell you what I mean by that. In the conservation space, this work is very expensive. So when we work to save natural resources, when we work to make sure there's adequate supplies of water, that the coastal communities are safe and intact and things like that, we need more than just Shell or Exxon to buy a table at a banquet. We need them to make an investment in the very places where they work. And the acceleration that I think would be interesting to see is getting out of that funding. And this is ultimately, this does all come down to money. Because the buckets of money that are there for philanthropic giving by the corporations do vary according to whether or not the year was profitable. But the money that is associated with projects, so every energy company in the world has massive projects going on, and the really important shift that we're seeing in the conservation community is they're now starting to calculate the cost of making an environmental investment up front. And the reason they're doing that is because these companies have now calculated that when you start to crash the environmental systems where you're fracking or drilling for oil or whatever it is that you're doing, that takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of lawyers, it keeps you in a regulatory process that has a ton of cost associated with it versus making a proactive investment in natural resource protection. And that's really the shift that we need to see. We need to be incorporated into the business model of companies. And once we see that, then we'll see investments that don't get cut during downturns because those business models don't take the hit. It's all the nice-to-have investments that take the hit. And I'll just pair this with this other comment, which is this. A lot of nonprofits get criticized when they do take money from corporations. So there's an irony at work here. We're one of the last global conservation organizations that still will take corporate money. And we answer tough questions about that. And so we've got to get past this irony of saying that there's got to be corporate responsibility, but none of us can take their money, because if we take their money, then somehow we're not achieving our mission in the most pure way possible. And I really like the way the Nature Conservancy tackles that conundrum, which is to say, we're not letting anybody off the hook. We think that in order to solve these great big problems, you've got to have the public sector, you've got to have the private sector, and you've got to have the nonprofit sector all investing. It's the only shot we have at solving big problems. But there is a big irony at work, and the media plays a role in asking those tough questions about whether or not that corporate money, you know, somehow dirties up the mission.
Thanks.
And I'm going to kind of approach this question from, you know, I'm a small business owner and I'm a volunteer. And so for me, defining social responsibility kind of comes from inspiration. I mean, you're going to hear me talk a lot about that today, because what I have to add is from a little bit of a different perspective. I haven't lived in the nonprofit world for very long. It's very new to me. I've spent 40 years of my life not being socially responsible. Till 2 years ago, so I feel a little, to be honest, you know. So, you know, in my opinion, it starts with inspiration, and I think that you know, you ought to be inspired and care about the cause that you're supporting. It's the only way it's going to be sustainable, or it's going to be a little bit like a flash in a pan, and it might make you feel good for a little bit, and it might make you look good, but it's really not going to have an impact in social responsibility long term. So, you know, just a few years ago, like I said, I wasn't socially responsible. I write checks to community events and get involved. I get my logo on a brochure and go through those motions. But it was getting inspired and hearing that story that made me, you know, get up and do something about it. And what I've learned is that it doesn't take much if you just get active. In a very, very short time, myself and four good friends have made a very, very very big impact in a very short period of time. And in my opinion, that's my definition of social responsibility.
That was great. I found myself thinking, Laura, while you were speaking, about The Lorax. I have two small children, so I spend a lot of time with the book The Lorax. Probably more time than I should with the movie that I often just put on instead of reading the book. And I, you know, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the story, but it's this guy, and he's like out in his little wagon, and he's riding around in some beautiful wilderness, and he sees this tree, and he cuts down the tree, and then he produces this thing from the tree, and then he decides that everybody needs this thing that he made. And so quickly you fast forward to the end of the film, or the book, where the environment is gone, and the product is now not able to be produced either. And so I think that there is this, it would be wonderful if we lived in a world where corporations, big businesses, small businesses understood from the very beginning that there was this upfront investment needed, whether it's in the environment or where, you know, whatever sort of capital is being reduced in the production of something, to ensure that there is an even track with both of those things.
Well, and you know, really it has to do with identifying the nexus between what it is that the company is doing and where their natural social investment would be. So for Tom's, I love that. You know, they're making shoes and they're giving shoes away. They're making glasses and giving glasses away. I think, you know, you can't get a tighter nexus than that. What they sell, they give. When we work a lot with extractive industries. You know, this is oil production. These are people that are taking natural resources and selling them. We almost have to be working with those extractive companies because they're the ones that are either maintaining an equilibrium or compromising and crashing environmental systems. And so to me, it's the most authentic and the most sustainable when there is a nexus between what the company does and how they handle their social responsibility. And I also think it's more appealing to employees. If I'm working for an organization that is producing shoes and our social equity program is completely unrelated to that, that to me is just less meaningful than if the social equity piece and the core business are closer to a match. And so it feels very natural to me, but it's not as widespread, it's not as deep as it should be, because it is very appealing to buy a table at a chamber event, to do something that includes branding along with it. And these companies are rightfully concerned with the branding that comes with their investments. And so they've got to strike a balance between seeing their names in programs, like you could see in this program, I'm sure, versus making investments that really go to core missions of what we're trying to do to solve problems.
Laura, what I think is interesting about what you're saying, I think a big struggle, I'm lucky, right? I'm in a company that was founded with social impact baked into our business model. If you tried to take it out, the company would fail. It would collapse. So there's no way to extract it. You cannot decouple those things. But, I mean, I've sort of been saying this quotation I heard the other day over and over to myself lately, which is that the end of the quarter comes before the end of the world. So when you think about, you know, the companies that you work for, the business pressures you have on the week or the month or the quarter or the year or whatever it is very different than this ecosystem, for, you know, from an environmental standpoint. Yep. Or, you know, the time scale to seeing any kind of true ROI for your business, which is what the folks making the decisions often care about because that's what they're compensated. Like, we need to be realistic about where people's incentives are coming from. We have to find a way in those kind of businesses that aren't like Tom's to reconcile those two time scales, the very short, maybe quarterly, and then the, like, generational time span of protecting natural resources or improving labor conditions for workers or whatever that will trickle back over time. But when you're making a decision today and are crunched today, it's really hard sometimes to make that case for that investment. So I think sometimes you have to find a way to, like, carve out a space to experiment that is not beholden to that very tight timeline. If you're in a position to convince somebody in your company, give me a little pot of money to start with or a little bit of resource to start with and see if I can prove to you, maybe not in this quarter, but this year, that there can be some benefit to our business. You know, get like a little firewall around yourself. To me, in a business that, again, is not like the one I'm lucky to work for, I think you have to be really hard-headed about diagnosing. Put your idealism aside, diagnosing what kind of environment do I work in? Am I actually going to be given the space to experiment? Or is it like when the quarter comes around, too bad, if you didn't show me the money, then whatever little pet project you had gets relegated over to the pet project area where none of us wants to be. So I think you have to be really kind of really look and go, is this a place where I could find someone willing to take a chance and carve this out for me? Or do I have to go rogue and ask for forgiveness later instead of permission now? I mean, you really have to kind of be a little intrapreneur, they call it, you know, and kind of chop and change where you are based on those very different life cycles.
Which is a perfect segue to our second talking point.
No,
perfect. Thank you for setting us up. So what suggestions, if any, do the panelists have for people who might work in businesses where there aren't currently such social engagement opportunities?
Oh, good. I'm done.
Go rogue, apparently, is Jessica's.
Well,
go rogue.
Diagnose, and then one of the possible outcomes of your diagnosis might be that you have to go rogue. Maybe not.
Well, and which...
See resume writing workshop next.
My first thought is think about why your company's not socially responsible or engaged in the community. I mean, that's the big question. You know, I think that, and remember, we're talking about the people of that company, not the company itself. So that means, in my opinion, there's no one in there activating and getting that company excited or inspired to do anything. So, you know, I would maybe look inside yourself and decide if you might be willing to be that person or be that spark that can make change in your company. you know, there's, if you're a leader, there's many things you can do. You can hire motivational speakers that'll come in and give great ideas and inspire your employees to get involved. You can lead by example, which is, you know, I know that's cliche, but it's extremely important. Your employees will follow you. And you can create opportunities to, you can incentivize them to get involved, give back, match their giving, and reward their efforts. I think as if you're an employee and you work for a company and your company is not socially responsible, I'd first look at your coworkers and try to find a small group of like-minded folks that you pick a topic you can get really excited about. And, you know, find ways to get involved that interest you and then go to your leaders and ask them to match your efforts. Go to them and say, you know, I'm going to do this and I think this company should do it too and you owe it to us to match us and get behind us. So I think there's a lot of ways to make changes.
And I would say this, make the business case. Look, you're at a women's conference. You're here because you're not particularly interested in incremental growth professionally. You're trying to figure out how you can accelerate your growth. So, you know, turn this into a business case for the organization. I don't think it's as hard as people imagine to get companies to really start thinking about what their natural investment should be. And I'll give you two quick examples. It took us probably 4 meetings with Dr. Pepper Snapple for them to write a $1 million check to the Nature Conservancy in Texas to protect the watersheds in which they produce Dr. Pepper and Snapple products. Why did they do that? Because they understand that water is the most important environmental issue facing the state of Texas today. They understand that if they're not seen as helping to protect that natural resource, and if they are not doing it practically, then they could be in a world of hurt. Mm-hmm. And so they're protecting their bottom line, but they're also showing these communities where they produce these products that they're going to make a meaningful investment so that these natural resources are available. It did not take very much to show the company. And frankly, I view it as my job and those of us that are in the nonprofit sector to demonstrate to companies where that nexus is. We did the same thing with Dow Chemical. You know, what environmental organization in their right mind, you know, partners with Dow Chemical? Well, we did. And the reason that we did is because we were trying to see if we could get into their business model, if they were thinking about natural resources the way they needed to be thinking about natural resources. And what we learned together was, and I'll just give you one example, but it's got global implications. It's a global company. What we learned was that, you know, they're frequently located right near the ocean. In fact, Freeport, Texas is in the ocean almost. And what we learned is that they, as their engineers design seawalls and levees and things to keep storms from creaming their factory, and by the way, we're seeing more storms and they're more intense, so this is a increasing risk for them, so you want to be thinking about that. We saw that in their models, they treated marshes as though they were parking lots. Well, marshes are not parking lots. Marshes are part of a wonderful natural infrastructure that has wave attenuating benefits. It functions as the ocean sponge. And when they treated the saltwater marshes as natural infrastructure instead of a parking lot, it immediately shrunk the size of the capital improvement project they needed for coastal resilience. And in that way, we showed them that an investment in natural infrastructure could save them money, which they loved, but also create all sorts of compounding benefits for nature. So my appeal to you is get into the business model. You're women that are trying to lead these companies. Appeal to the business model and show your leadership that it's in their best interest to make investments in social equity. And I'm giving you examples from the environmental space, but there are examples in all of the social spaces where you could make this connection for people. And then you're appealing to what they're having to worry about, which is the end of the quarter comes before the end of the world. I can't make end of the world arguments. They don't sell that well.
Yep. I heard a successful entrepreneur speak years ago who, this is going to sound funny coming out of the mouth of a social entrepreneur, but always stayed with me. He talked about sales pitch is fear, greed, and then fear again. I'm not talking fire and brimstone. I'm not talking go in bleeding heart and say this, you know, end of the world is going to happen. But this is what people, when they're thinking about business case, this is what's going to happen if you don't do this. You're going to get hit with, you know, multi-million dollar damage because of storms. Then the greed part. Okay, so now you're scared and you realize, oh, maybe there's some benefit that you can get out of it. And then, remember, be scared again. These things, if you, your competition will get ahead of you or whatever. That little sandwich of fear, greed, fear, if you do it in the right way without, again, being scary or dramatic, can be a powerful way to present a business case, to take the emotion out of it and really show people what the benefit is going to be, especially if you have folks that aren't leading with their heart, which not all business people do, not enough.
Well, just one quick comment about the fear, greed, fear sandwich. I would just wrap it up with something that is warmer.
Of course.
I do think that, you know,
they don't need to know they're being sold fear, greed, fear.
Right.
You package it. We're women. You package it nicely.
Well.
But you're talking to their deepest instincts.
You're appealing to the business model, and you're giving them a meaningful reason to invest. But what always sits next to that is their desire to market, you know, that investment in the communities where they work, especially if they've got vulnerabilities because of what they're doing and how they're doing it. And, you know, I hear this over and over again. There's no corporate gift that we take right now where they don't ask us to explicitly propose to them how we're going to create employee engagement days. Every single time we make a proposal to a company, they ask us to roll that in. So we've got employees from all over Texas coming out to preserves, doing cleanup days, doing tree plantings. And so your appeal, explaining to your employer why this is important to you and why it's important to them, that combination is really, really powerful. We don't make any proposal where they don't ask us to show them how they can get their employees personally engaged.
So then my next question to the esteemed panelists is, for the people in the room who have been deeply moved and inspired by hearing your stories of how you're making a living working in these places where you get to do good business and change the world, do you have any suggestions for how one goes about making a career shift around those things? If in hearing this, or maybe you came here today because you're thinking of moving your own professional career trajectory into a stream where there's more room for engagement and inspiration, do you guys have any suggestions?
Go ahead.
You should start.
Okay. I do have some thoughts about this. I think making a career shift without, you know, I think it's drastic, so I would first look at it where you are and if you can make a change within your company where you work. And I think we kind of addressed that in the last question. A lot of good ideas. But if you're truly thinking about a career shift, then I think you have to find the motivation and allow that to drive you. All I can do is give you a personal example for me. What I do for a living and how I make my money, I like to call it my work of art. So I think everybody has their own work of art, whether you do accounting or, you're a doctor or you sell shoes or, you know, whatever it is you do, that's your work of art, and you're an expert at that. But that thing that I do for no strings attached, I like to call that my work of heart. And so my work of heart is, it completes me. It's that little extra beside my work of art piece that once I found it has enriched my life. So if you're truly, truly thinking about making a career shift, I would try to figure out what your work of heart is and whether you can find that in the company where you are now or whether you need to go somewhere else. If you have no idea where to begin, my suggestion would be to read the book Lone Survivor. And I am not trying to get you pushed towards a military cause, because that book is life-changing and will inspire you to find your work of heart no matter what it is. And in that book, if you haven't read it, it's a story about 19 special ops who died in Afghanistan back in 2005. And two of the surviving spouses of that incident are here today, and I'd like them to stand, if you don't mind. Cindy Axelson and Char Westfall Fontaine. These ladies are my work of heart. Tiffany Eckert, are you here, Tiffany? She's not here. Shirley Anna and Raylene, are you here? You mind standing? This lady served our country alongside their husbands who are active duty military, and you guys are my work of heart. So please join me in honoring this group of women who sacrificed more than any of us can ever imagine.
Want to try to follow that, anybody?
Thank you. for your sacrifice and your service. Did I mention yet that I'm ridiculously practical? I've got two pieces of advice. One is has nothing to do with profession and everything to do with it, which is if you aren't already, find a way to start living below your financial means. Because living at or above your financial means is a pair of handcuffs that you can never get out of. If you your mortgage, your car payments, whatever, if you ramp these nice things up over the course of your life, you will never have the financial freedom to make a break from what you're doing and do something else. So, I mean, I have two small children now. Neither of them is old enough for the state of Texas to be educating them, so we have no extra money. So I'm not living below my means now, but, I mean, my husband and I have always tried because right now he is starting his own business. So we were living so far below our means that he was able to take that risk. If we had been right at it, he could never have left that with our childcare expenses, our mortgage, or whatever. So to me, that's number one. Whether it's social impact or some other passion to follow in your life, just unshackle yourself from, and I know it's very hard to do, but there are, I think, simple things you can do to do it. And the other to me is to look at your skill set. I think if you're just starting out in your career, and I'm looking around the room, and I don't see that many, no offense, 22-looking-year-old people here, then you can kind of go into anything. You look great, though. Maybe I'll look 23. Then you can kind of go into anything and build your skill set as you go. And that is true any point in your career, especially if you're living below your means. But you already have some kind of skill set, right? Leverage that into whatever new organization or new role you want to be. Then maybe you can learn laterally. If you're an amazing bookkeeper, you don't want to be doing that for the rest of your life. Maybe you can go be a bookkeeper at a great social impact organization and then learn on the job, if you don't want to keep doing that, how to do the other stuff there. Don't, you know, take your assets with you if you can, so that you can get your foot in the door where you want to be.
Well, I'll just say this. Consider a public service career. Of all the people that I know that are mid-career, those public service careers really stand the test of time because they're meaningful work. And, you know, the money might matter in your 20s and 30s, but at some point you'll look up and wonder what it all adds up to. And public service makes a difference. It's tangible. You can come at it from a million different ways. You can live anywhere in the world. It is not necessarily lock you into low-paying jobs for the rest of your life. You know, there are some well-paid public service jobs. And I think just taking a peek at that, if you're looking for a career shift, is worth your time. It's worth your time. I made a major career shift in my mid-40s, early 40s, actually, and it was terrific. I had been doing the same thing for nearly 20 years. I saw very few surprises. I was very proficient at what I did, and it was delightful to become a non-expert again. It was wonderful in my early 40s to be able to say, I don't know what I don't know, and to learn. And it retaught me some of those skills that do make good leaders, how to listen, how to lead, how to be gracious. And sometimes you don't get that if you stay in the same career for 20 or 30 years. You're exhausted and you're not enthusiastic, but you don't recognize that about yourself. So public service. The other thing, and this is terribly, terribly practical, once you get your resume updated, don't ever let it fall by the wayside. It is the number one thing we all procrastinate about. It's a pain. You'll at some point get it updated, and then every single change that happens, make sure you get into that document and just keep it fresh. You will use it more often. You will find opportunities to get your resume out there if it's accurate. And the only way for it to be accurate is to stay on top of it. So at whatever point you choose to get that thing updated, stay on it after that.
I would just like to chime in with one thing, if I may, as the moderator. My mother works in HR, so I grew up in a household where I was always hearing this exact advice, right? Like, all about marketing yourself. And what she tells me and tells all of my siblings is that even when you're perfectly happy in your job, you should go on no less than 2 job interviews a year. Just to keep it fresh and just to sit in a room and answer questions about your own professional experience, to see what's out there, especially for on those days when you're like, oh, my God, I hate my job, which does not happen to me very often, but I know that it happens, that you can then remember, but I'm not stuck here. There are other options. And, you know, if you were just wanted to sniff out the social entrepreneurial part of the sector of whatever it is you work in, you know, just going on some informational interviews, I think, is a good experience as well, just to figure out what it is.
So we have about 15 minutes left, and I want to make sure that we have enough time for the audience to interact with you guys. So don't shoot me. I'm going to skip the last question. And I'm going to jump to asking the three of you to share with us three very specific things that people can do, people in this room can do when they return to their workplace that could enhance the sense of social responsibility, social justice, social change, whatever that means to you guys. Whoever would like to start can go.
Three each.
I mean, you've already said many. I could remind you.
I'm going to say one for now, and then I'm going to think longer. One, I think, would be go find someone in a totally different function in the business and do an informational interview with them. Not on leave to the side for now. How do we change the world? How can we go learn what they do? Ask them what drives them, what incentivizes them, what decisions they have. Just start. This is something I really have. Tom's is now the biggest organization I've ever worked in. We're over 500 people, and I'm much more on the startup end. So I'm doing and going, okay, you're supply chain. What drives you? What interests you? What are the pressures on you? If you can learn what those things are for different functions of the business, you then get this 360 picture that then helps you make, I think, smart decisions about where you could start to try to affect change. If you don't know what's making people make decisions, you're probably not going to get very far. That's number one.
Thank you.
To be continued.
I'd say this. Find out what your company is investing in now. Look at the mission statement and ask questions about how the company structures its philanthropic giving. Find out if it's a separate pot of money. If it's a separate pot of money, ask, see if you can figure out how those decisions are made. I'm continually shocked at how loosey-goosey those decision-making processes are. They're barely populated with named committees. Those are wonderful opportunities for you to penetrate and be part of the decision-making process. Find out if there are any investments made as a business model versus a philanthropic model. And then the last one is, see if the company has a sustainability plan. And if it does, read it. That's going to tell you how the company's thinking about its own sustainability, and that will show you the map for that kind of social responsibility and how they're thinking about the giving.
Sherry?
And remember, I don't work for a company. I work for myself. So so I'm going to tackle this on the individual level. And for me, you know, I wrote down the three action items would be the three A's. Get aware, get awakened, and get active. So being aware is educating yourself, understanding the needs that are out there. Getting awakened is the part of the inspiration part of this. And getting involved is obvious. Get involved, get your organization involved, get your friends involved, get your family involved. One of my favorite quotes by Margaret Mead, she says it best. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. In fact, it is the only thing that ever has. Our small group, these ladies here, did not anticipate the impact we'd have on a national level. But what we started with the work of five like-minded, concerned citizens has become a national movement to awaken the patriot in us all, and it seems to be working.
Thanks. So does anybody in the audience have any questions or any comments? You can move to the microphones that are on the side there, or you can shout loudly. We are Texans.
I've been in the nonprofit world almost all my career, and I would like to allude to a couple things. One, as we have a mission and a cause, we know the importance of that mission and cause. Our responsibility is to help the businesses relate and find where that intersection is. Mm-hmm. At one point in my career, I was with United Way, and my responsibility was to call on those large companies and those small businesses that were not involved with the United Way and see if we could find a point. The main thing is to ask questions, to ask those questions about what drives their business, what are they facing. Then you and that first meeting is a lot of questions and listening. Then you come back with your proposal, because then you come back with the proposal that fits what they need. And at the other end, you have to make sure that when they do invest, that they feel like they've made the very best investment around, and they have a lot of competition for requests and opportunities. Find out when their stockholders meeting is. Find out when their report goes, their annual report goes out. find out when they have a newsletter going out to their stockholders and prepare, be proactive, prepare the information for them so they can easily drop it in, so they can easily feature their public support and involvement. So it's front end and back end, because you want them to feel like this was the best investment they've ever made. So it's just a comment.
Thank you. I invite you to travel to the microphones so that the people in the back can hear you. I'm sorry being mean.
Thank you. And thank you all for speaking to us. I'd like to ask you about collaboration. I've spent my whole career in corporate America, and we were sharks, and we like the taste of blood, and we admit that out loud. And it's a great place to work because everybody knows what the rules are. I recently sold my businesses to start a nonprofit for women veterans, and I thought it's social good, it's social responsibility, everybody's going to work together. What I realized in the nonprofit world is the word collaboration really doesn't happen a lot. We talk about it, especially as women, we say we help each other, but the reality is we really don't. And so how are you guys working to collaborate with other organizations that are doing social good or doing something either in your same arena or possibly something different?
I feel your pain. When I worked in the nonprofit sector, I could curl your hair. I could curl your hair with stories in the nonprofit sector. I ran a hunger-focused nonprofit years ago, and I had somebody I was trying to collaborate with this other organization. And then a third party told me, just give up. And I said, why? She said, she told me she doesn't want to talk to you because she's afraid you'll take her hungry people. That's sometimes a reality of the dysfunction in the nonprofit space where resources are scarce and people have to fight for them. And anyway, I'll give you Tom's example. I don't know if it helps, but we just launched 2 weeks ago something called Tom's Marketplace. So we're using our e-commerce platform. We've got about 30 businesses whose products do some kind of social good. It's a lot in the kind of apparel similar to our brand space, and we're giving them a much bigger platform than they had before. They tend to be smaller than us to sell their products. For us, it's a win-win. You know, it's not completely altruistic. It's, you know, they are paying to be, you know, on our e-commerce platform. But for us, it's also a furtherance of our mission. So it's we believe business can change the world. So let's bring more businesses forward. We're an entrepreneurial company. Let's celebrate entrepreneurs. So I wasn't my idea. I didn't execute it. I think it's really cool that Tom's has done that because it's that sweet spot of doing good for us and doing good for others and strengthening our brand.
I also think it's kind of a choice you make when you lead a nonprofit. I mean, you can choose to be competitive, or you can choose to be collaborative. And so someone's got to, you know, there's got to be a grown-up in the room at some point. And the way, you know, the environmental space can be nasty, or it can be really, really collaborative. I actually think the environmental space in the state of Texas is some of the most collaborative work that happens in this country. And it's easy for me because I know what we're good at, and I'm not trying to compete with organizations that are doing something slightly different and they're better at it. So part of it in my space is making sure that – so the Nature Conservancy is the oldest, largest conservation organization in the world. And my message to my staff is if we are competing on local issues, then what that means is we are dragging down our resources and we can't work at the scale that we need to be working at. Other organizations can do smaller projects. Very few organizations can do great big at-scale projects. So some of it to me – number one, it's a choice. We're living in a world where everybody wants to juxtapose. So be different. Just don't do it. And once you get started, then everybody else starts to unwind that behavior as well. And I've seen that happen. The best example I've seen in the state of Texas of that happening is post-oil spill, Gulf of Mexico. Lots of money is going to be rolling in for good environmental projects. And in Texas, the environmental community, conservation community, is organized. We know what each of us are going to be good at. We know what we're trying to accomplish in terms of, you know, kind of rebuilding that whole system. And it's working very nicely. In fact, Texas has become the example for the rest of the Gulf states. So it can be done, but it starts with a personal choice that you're not going to lead that way.
Yeah, I agree. I remember early in my career, so I founded the organization that I run. We'll be 10 years old in January. We've served 3 million women. We're in our 13th humanitarian response in the Philippines right now. And I was 30 when I started the organization. And I was in Tibet, which was our first field program. And I was sitting in a coordination meeting. And everyone in the room was going around. And this is, hi, this is who I am. And this is my organization. We do water, or we do schools, or we do hospitals. And hi, I'm Circle of Health, and we work with women. And this woman across the circle that were in the meeting where we were stood up,
pointed at me and said, "How old are you?" And I was like, "Ah, I'm 30. And she said, "You're way too young to be doing this. How can you know what you're doing? Blah, 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 blah." I was so terrified. I was so mortified. I was so embarrassed. I thought I'd made all of the wrong decisions. By the end of the 8 weeks that we were there, she was our strongest champion. She wanted to partner with us officially the next year. And I mean, this was not like me at all knowing what I was doing. I just, my natural response in that situation was to not meet that with the aggression that came at me. And I think in the nonprofit sector, there is this scarcity mentality that there aren't enough resources for all the hungry people. Like, don't take my hungry people. You know, God willing, we were in a world where there wasn't a need right. for what we all do, right? So that is what I'm working towards. Put me out of work, please. But until that day, as the leader of this organization, I want to model a culture of collaboration. And even if that means that things take way longer than they should sometimes, I'm just going to continue to show up that way and see how it goes. Yes.
So I hate microphones, just so you know.
Sorry. I just want everyone to be able to hear you.
Laura had mentioned that we have to get away from this irony, right, of encouraging social responsibility from corporations and yet not willing to cooperate or coordinate with them. Do you think there is also the irony that we expect people who work in the nonprofit world should not be paid? Because I've seen ads like those, like Philadelphia Magazine. I'm from Philadelphia originally, somewhat originally. But 2 years ago, they actually published the salaries of executives at nonprofits. And it's interesting because I volunteer a lot with nonprofits, and part of the reason is because I don't want to be stigmatized as, oh, she's doing okay financially. She should not be getting paid. Nonprofits should all be made of a bunch of volunteers, not experienced people who know what they're doing on how to fundraise and how to, basically have an organization. Do you think there is that stigma, and perhaps as a society, we need to get away from that stigma?
Yeah, we need to get over it. That's what we need to get.
Actually,
this is my first nonprofit. My background before this was in government. I was blown away by that logic. It makes no sense to me, and it can be very insidious in nonprofits, and it goes a little bit like this. If you really care about the mission, I mean really, like if you're authentically us, then it won't matter what your paycheck is. Well, that's just nonsense. I mean, who makes that argument? And here's what's going to make that change. And I call that using the mission as a weapon, right? So I will measure your passion for this this organization using my teaspoons, and I will tell you how you shape up. And I care a lot about this because people get to come at these issues in their own way, right? You get to be you, as my teenage daughter says, you be you. Here's what's changing that. The people that are investing, and you alluded to this, people that are investing in nonprofits, and now I'm talking about companies, wealthy individuals, and foundations, are making sure that our nonprofits are being run like businesses. They care about good management, and you've got to answer those tough questions about performance and accountability because they are asking them, which means that we're being viewed differently. You know, I need the Nature Conservancy to be viewed as a blue chip conservation organization where your multi-million dollar investment is guaranteed to produce results. And I can't do that unless I'm managing an organization that can, you know, that can show that to you in terms of good old-fashioned business measures. And when we see that shift, we'll see the salaries that come along with it. Because the tradition in nonprofits is you find the person with the most passion and make them the executive director. Well, that doesn't work that great for a business model. That doesn't hold up to external audits very well.
But there's a twinned issue to this, which is the funding. If your overhead, i.e. the people that you pay, is too large a percentage of your overall budget as a nonprofit, your charity navigator rating goes down. And people will write a nasty article about you. Why is their rating so low? What's the corruption? Whatever. Because we consider the people that do the work, funders consider the people that do the work to not be the essential part of the work. It has to go to program cost, program. You got to be 90, 95, 98%, which means don't pay people a lot of money. So some of the dysfunction's coming from the funder end, too, the foundation end.
Hey, guys, we're at the top of the hour. We got to stop. But that was really good. and I was like trying to find this book that I just read about this while I wasn't being distracted, I promise. I was trying to find the name of this book. Anyway, I thank you all for coming, and I hope that this was useful, that you feel inspired, that you feel engaged, and you've got some tips to go out and infuse your workplace with some heightened sense of doing some social good. And thank you to the panelists. You guys were great.
Thank you.
Thank you.